its ways, they're told they seek punishment. It's a really vicious catch-22. Now, the word masochism initially meant something very specific. It meant the enjoyment of pain. And you know how the word bad has come to mean good? Hey, you're bad, you know? That's a bad black leather jacket, all right? But everybody knows, I mean, everybody who would be being talked to like that, right, knows that bad, used that way, means good, right? So for that word, and for lots of other words in the English language, as the usage changes, people realize that the meaning is changing. And they keep in mind that changed meaning. So that, do you know what, I just heard this the other night, you know what the word gossip meant? It initially meant, wait, is that the word, is it gossip? There's a word like gossip, and maybe it's gossip that Dale Spender says it initially meant the woman who stayed with a pregnant woman when she was in labor and provided emotional support. There's now a project apparently going on where people are going back and looking at how all the words that are now used to insult women used to be very complimentary, sometimes quite moving words of tribute to women. And Dale Spender says that about 90% of words that were initially used to say admiring things about women and appreciative things about women have come to mean prostitute. Okay, so what's happened with the word masochism is that it has come to be applied to a whole host of behavior other than the seeking of pain. But nobody really thinks of a whole host of other behavior. When I say masochism, you think of seeking of pain, the enjoyment of suffering. So when Gertrude Lenzer, a feminist historian, wrote in 1975 about this phenomenon, she said, "Freud should have noted that it was surprising that the term masochism had spread so widely in so short a time, even within Freud's lifetime, and that it had been applied to different kinds of phenomena which were never before thought to have any relation to what had come to be understood as masochism." Now, I had an extremely intelligent feminist graduate student who'd read a great deal about theories of masochism in women, who'd been talking to me while I was in the process of writing this paper. She understood what I was saying, but she came to see me one day and she said, "Well, I've been thinking about this, and you know, the problem is it's really true. Women do behave masochistically, and that has to be explained." And I said, "Well, what behavior are you referring to?" And she said, "Women are often very nurturant, giving, self-denying people." And I found that chilling because she knew the problem. She knew what we were talking about. But the power of this word is such that her thinking had already been shaped. It was very hard for her to change her thinking. And what I want to suggest is that when we hear people calling women masochists, we relabel that behavior, because most of what's called masochistic behavior has one of the three other explanations that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. And much of it is even pro-social, mature, loving behavior that we should be admiring and appreciating women for showing. If that behavior is called masochistic, then of course we have to develop theories to explain them. So we have to make sure that we don't misapply the term. Now, in summary, one could take the position that even if you accept everything I've said tonight, women are also motivated by unconscious masochism. Part of the fascination to attempt to understand the unconscious is that it is impossible to prove that a particular bit of content or a particular kind of process really is there in the unconscious. It's interesting. I believe in the existence of the unconscious, but it's impossible to prove or disprove that something's really in there. It's not my purpose to prove that there's no such thing as unconscious masochism. My two purposes are to demonstrate, first of all, that the notion that women are unconsciously, naturally masochistic is entirely unnecessary, because all of the phenomena that need to be explained by a theory have other perfectly adequate, sensible explanations, most of which have to do with women's healthy, admirable behavior. And second, it's been my purpose to show that the notion that women are naturally, unconsciously masochistic does women a profound disservice. Okay, let me stop and have questions, comments, violent disagreement. Do we have time for questions? I mean, I can stay.
As long as people want to stay.
Okay. Yes.
I read a book by a group called Chinoy.
Yes.
Just
been writing about
it. I read part of it. And there are a group of lesbian feminists who engage in sadomasochism in a sexual manner. And they say in the book, you know, our consciousnesses are raised. You know, you can't tell us that our consciousnesses aren't raised. And we enjoy this. How does this fit with your...
Okay. Let me just say a bit about that book for people who aren't familiar with it. It's a book called Coming to Power, and it's written by a group of lesbian feminists who are involved in sadomasochistic practices, sexual sadomasochism. And anybody who reads that book should also read a book called Against Sadomasochism, which is a brilliant book. And it's an antidote to Coming to Power. Now, I read both books this summer as I was writing my chapter on women's bodies for this book. And here's what I found. If you keep in mind that it's possible to find other explanations than the seeking of suffering as you read Coming to Power, if you look at what these women are describing, you find that mostly they're not describing the seeking of suffering. There's a whole chapter in there on how to make sure nobody gets hurt in doing these practices, all right, which I was relieved to see. But you see, that, to me, that says calling this masochism is a complete misnomer. Some of it is about the prolonging of sexual arousal. Some of it is about how when you are sexually aroused, things that would hurt if you weren't sexually aroused are simply stimulating. They simply increase your pleasure. All right. Now, none of those things is masochistic. So most of what is written about in this book that's supposedly a promotion of masochism isn't about masochism. It's not about the enjoyment of suffering. Now, by the way, that book, the Toronto Women's Bookstore, which carries practically anything to do with women, and which has a lot of lesbians on its staff, refused to carry that book. They've never refused to carry a book before. some of what's in that book, however, is about real beatings. It's about women who really do submit to beatings and to the infliction of pain by their partners. And what you find in these women's descriptions is their self-esteem is so terrible, or their guilt about sex is so awful, that the pain is what Reich was talking about. It's expiation of the guilt so that they can then enjoy the sexual pleasure. And furthermore, some of the relationships in which these lesbian feminists stay, even though they are really being physically hurt quite badly, I mean, it's really horrible to think of women being hurt by other women. It's not very common, but it does happen. Some of these descriptions are very much like descriptions of abusive husbands and their wives. The women have poor self-esteem, or they have no one to turn to, or they are afraid they will be called a failure for not having been able to teach him to control his aggression. Because after all, women are supposed to save men. You know, we're supposed to be religious and good and moral, and we are supposed to tame the wild beasts in them. Or we're supposed to make sure that we don't nag them so that they beat us. My friend Karen Howe, who's a psychologist at Trenton State, said, gee, isn't it interesting? She said, nagging is when a woman asks for something, right? And so a lot of what gets said is that wife beaters beat their wives because the women elicited it, right? They knew he was in a bad mood. They should have kept their mouths shut that day, right? A lot of these men come home and wake their wives up and beat them. All right, so there's no question of the woman eliciting the beating. And in these really sadomasochistic lesbian sexual relationships, the description is frighteningly similar to that kind of thing. And invariably, the women don't enjoy the pain. It's the only way they can keep their partner, or it's the only way they can avoid further rejection, or they have no alternatives, no alternatives that they can be sure will be better. The social psychologists in the room will be familiar with Thibault and Kelly's theory of a comparison level of alternatives, which they're basically saying what I just said, that if you don't have anything you're sure is better, why leave? Yes?
I'd just like to make one comment about what you just said about the family.
Mm-hmm.
Women have been complaining that people don't take them seriously, or literally, I should say, when they speak. Don't listen to them. We've been complaining, you talk about how psychoanalysis and psychology is a bad education. Translating what women want to be saying and think they're saying into something else. I'd just like to make two points. I don't think it speaks very well for feminist women to refuse to carry a book by people who are talking about whatever phenomenon in the store that carries books by feminists or women or anything else. People can buy the book and throw up or get angry, but that kind of self-censorship is sort of a horrible thing to find in the women's movement. And the second thing is, what you've just expressed in your analysis of that book has very much the hallmark of condescension and rephrasing and not taking seriously what these people are saying. I find it really distasteful to be told to have them psychoanalyze sort of on the spot that they really are, you know. And this is what you've been complaining about in your whole talk. And here you're telling us that these women really have low self-esteem and they're really battering each other and it's just as bad as being battered by a man. And I think that I would just like to say that I think you've misrepresented the book to a certain extent, and you've done it in a way that had a sort of patronizing air to it, which I think we ought to avoid as feminists, just listen to what people have to say. It is a challenging book, it disturbs a lot of people. They're making a certain kind of case, and you have to listen to them carefully. You can't just translate back into concepts you already have in your head. I think you've done that book a very big, a great injustice, and the kind of injustice that we ought to all avoid as feminists.
Well, I appreciate your comments, and I don't like to sound patronizing. I didn't. My feeling is that what I was doing was taking the words of these women and just presenting them. I was trying to think as you were speaking of translations that I made. Direct quotations include the list of ways to avoid hurting your partner in these supposedly sadomasochistic encounters. A woman who calls herself Juicy Lucy in the book, which I love, talks about, she says, when I use the terms sadism and masochism, I mean the prolonging of pleasure. I mean when my partner does things to me that would hurt if I were not aroused. They don't hurt, they're stimulating. I don't feel I'm going beyond what these women themselves say. The women in, some of the women in Coming to Power and in Against Sadomasochism talk about how they were deeply involved in Samoy and got out because their lives were at risk. Their partners almost killed them. They talked about the need for opening battered lesbian feminist shelters. I simply didn't see any sign in either of these books that any of these women enjoy pain. Now, I guess there's a part of their argument I didn't present, and it's a big part of the book Coming to Power. And that is, they say, look, women have had their sexuality controlled forever. They've been told what it's okay to feel and what it's not okay to feel. And it's been hard enough for even the women's movement, never mind the rest of society, to embrace lesbians, to allow lesbians into feminist meetings and so on. And they're saying, isn't it just another form of oppression of women for some women to say, don't hurt each other physically. If we want to hurt each other, we can. We enjoy it. So I think that's a fair summary of what they said. No, would you like to say what I'm leaving out? Well, I think perhaps people would like to hear what you feel I've left out and what they're saying. I think I feel it's important to present that. If I haven't been able to do it, I would like somebody to say what they are saying. Yes?
I don't want to say what you're saying.
Okay. Well, you can all go read the book now. Anyway, we just increase their sales.
I think just that the important point is the extent to which one reproduces the very things that you have said and that I think that we have to get away from. I want to talk about a different issue, if that's okay. The one thing I want to say first is it disturbed me somewhat when you made these distinctions between who's a feminist theorist and who isn't, based on this notion of their particular formulation of what masochism might be or the use of the term. It seems not useful to me to either imply or say explicitly that someone like Juliet Mitchell is not a feminist theorist. Primarily because I think that the kind of work she's doing is a different reading of Freud from yours, and it seems to me there are many ways of reading Freud and using psychoanalysis. And her particular reading of Freud is an attempt, I think, to talk about sexuality as something that's socially constructed, and to talk about gender difference as something that's socially constructed, and to take a kind of biological determinism, to read that kind of determinism out of Freud, based on the assumption that there's something other than biological determinism in Freud in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it seems important to me, in terms of differentiations, which is what it seems your talk is really about. I mean, avoiding labels which simply collapse and reduce a whole set of things to one thing which has been judged moralistically as well as in many other ways. I guess that if I have a question, it really is, what does it mean to take all sorts of what you've said have been labeled masochistic behaviors and sort of obscure, distorted, in that way? What does it mean to sort of redefine those, if that's what you're doing, as behaviors which are not desirous of pain, but in fact circuitous routes toward pleasure? I'm just wondering whether sort of just redefining things which have been viewed as feminine and negative, as masochistic, to redefine those as in some way misguided attempts at pleasure or happiness. I mean, does that make for greater differentiation and precision in how we look at behaviors? And does it allow us to talk about a range of what you might call the pursuit of happiness or growth? I mean, I guess I didn't see in your argument where a greater precision or differentiation.
Okay, good points. I'd like to respond to about 8 things you said, and I'm not sure I can remember them all. First of all, the point about labeling some people feminist theorists. The people I labeled feminist theorists are the people that call themselves feminist theorists. And my point in talking about them was to say that they had taken us a quantum leap ahead of where the psychoanalysts had left us. And I think that comes from their being feminists. I don't think it comes from something they just happened onto. I think they took a questioning view of psychoanalytic theory that led to some progress being made. I would not say Juliet Mitchell isn't a feminist. What I said about her, I tried to say, was that just because someone calls themselves a feminist doesn't mean that they're not going to say things, probably inadvertently, that aren't destructive to women. And yes, I take a very moralistic view of people continuing to say that masochism is feminine and that it's inevitable in women, because I think that what's done with that theory is profoundly immoral. It's devastating to women. And that relates to your last comment about does the relabeling of this behavior have any use, and does it help us? As long as a woman, and people, people who work with battered women, people who work with women in unhappy relationships, people who have tried to help women who are in unhappy situations at work, people who've tried to work with mothers who blame themselves for everything that goes wrong with their children, even if nothing's wrong, but they're scared it is, find that if you say, well, you know, you stay there because you must be getting something out of it. I mean, you know that there are lots of mental health professionals that still say or imply that insidiously in the therapy that they do. If you say that, if you were that woman, you might as well give up. Why try to fight it? You're fighting your instinct. You got yourself into this. There's something in you that's keeping you there. There's something in you that seeks that unhappiness. If, however, you say, you're not seeking suffering, I don't believe for a minute that you enjoy it. First of all, the woman's self-esteem just skyrockets, right? It's being told that you're evil and dirty if you're told you seek suffering. It's really pathological. Women who are told they seek suffering and they bring it on themselves feel awful about themselves. If somebody says to them, I don't think you really want to suffer, and I think it's possible to find a better way. Well, how do you find a better way? You got to find out first, what is it you're really looking for? If what you're looking for is to keep your marriage together, then once you're told, no, you don't stay with him even though he beats you because you like the beating, you stay with him because you're scared there's nothing better out there and because your self-esteem is already rock bottom. And so you're scared to take any risk. You don't have any resources. Then it's obvious what you have to do. You have to find ways to help this woman develop her self-esteem. You have to help her find other supports besides depending on her husband or other people out there who are going to reject her if she leaves him. And so I think the relabeling is an extremely important first step because it makes you realize the evil is not within. You can identify where the evil is. It's not you that's keeping yourself in this suffering situation. It's society. Or it's the people that you're allowing to control your behavior.
Mm-hmm. Last year in Ms. Magazine, there was an article on sexuality and on sexual fantasies and the importance of those. Following that issue, a woman wrote in a letter to the editor saying, I think I need help. I think there's something wrong with me. I was an incest victim as a child, and now the majority of my sexual fantasies focus on sexual abuse by men, and that seems to be the only successful fantasies that I have now. The following issue was just flooded with women writing letters like, yes, I was a victim of various kinds of child abuse or rape, and I have and same goes for me. My sexual fantasies all seem to focus around abuse. Is that masochism, or how would you label it? I mean,
thank God I can't speak from personal experience. I was not ever sexually abused, and I was not ever raped. And so I have to rely on what other people say. And I know that a lot of writing that's been done about rape fantasies follows the pattern that what leads, they go through a fantasy of being not raped, not hurt, not violated, but of being thought to be so desirable the man can't help himself. All right, that's one category of what are called rape fantasies. I wouldn't call them rape fantasies. I think they're theories about being, you know, desired, right? And I have friends who have told me, you know, I have rape fantasies, and I said, well, what are they like? And they tell me, and it would never have occurred to me to call those a rape fantasy. There's another set of fantasies that are called rape fantasies that fit the pattern that you've described, in which often the women have poor self-esteem, and what's happened is that their introduction to sexuality was violent. For some of those people, as you know, with incest victims, for some, they felt, although at least ambivalent, there was part of them that felt special for being singled out, and they and Daddy had a secret, and so on. And so often what has happened is, for them, the experience of sexuality may involve violence, may involve coercion, but it also involves that feeling of being special, right? So those are two of the major categories. So somebody said, there are two articles, one was in Ms. and one was in Village Voice in the mid to late 70s. One was by Molly Haskell and one was by Signe Hammer. And one of those women quoted a friend of hers as saying, so-called rape fantasies are not about having your vagina ripped apart. They're about Robert Redford not being able to help himself. And they both said, and I have had rape victims tell me as well, I used to have what I called rape fantasies, but once I was really raped, I've never fantasized about it again. And I realized that what I was calling rape fantasies were not fantasies of what rape is really like. Yes?
Do you believe that there's such a thing as a masochist, a female masochist? I mean, it seems like every time something is labeled, we can put it into terms of your theory and say low self-esteem, this and that, but is there such a thing? I mean, do you believe there is a woman masochist or even a male masochist? I mean, people that actually enjoy pain, or do you think that that's
utterly
ridiculous altogether?
Well, I think, I say in the article, I've never met a masochist. I don't believe there is such a thing. Partly by definition, the enjoyment of pain, if you're enjoying it, it's something else. All right? I mean, it's very strange the way this whole theory has developed and persisted. I had a patient who is a poet and an actress, and she has a very vivid ability to call up imagery. And she said to me, she didn't know I was working on this article at the time, she came in and said to me, I had an argument with my boyfriend. And this was a woman who'd never expressed anger outright in her life. And she said, well, I did it. I got really angry at him. And I said, what happened? Because she'd been afraid for 25 years if she ever got really angry at somebody, they would leave her, they would be destroyed, they would destroy her. And she said, I understand why you're mad. I didn't mean to come across that way, but I'll try not to do it again. I said, wow, how did you feel? And she said, I expected her to say, oh, relieved, now I don't have to worry anymore, right? She said, I had this vivid image. I wanted to take my fingernails and dig them into my flesh and rip it from my body. And I imagined the blood dripping down when I did that. And I thought, well, I'll stop writing this paper because that's a masochistic image if I ever heard one. And then I said to her, what would that have meant? What's the flesh? What's the feeling of ripping that off? Well, what had happened, as she described the feeling, was that having believed for 25 years that her anger was fatal, one experience that was a good experience was just a lucky break. And having expressed some anger, you know what happens when you express it for the first time, you start to feel all the other anger that's under there. And she was absolutely terrified because she knew she'd just been lucky that once. He was a nice guy, and fate had been on her side. And she was so terrified by the anger, the 25 years of anger that was welling up inside her, that what she wanted to do was to tear that from her so that she wouldn't have to take the risk ever again. Yes?
You certainly developed a strong case for saying that there is no such thing as masochism. But it would certainly surprise me a great deal if in our society, you could build a very strong case for it if it existed within our own society, taking more societal forces rather than individual sort of Freudian notions. For example, children are beaten and then are loved at the same time. Mm-hmm. Love and pain being associated with each other. Men are knocked down on the football field and both the knocker downer and the knockdownee are cheered by everybody.
Yes.
We could look, men are killed in battle and they are declared as heroes. And their mothers are praised, and we have bands that play and everything that goes along with that, associated sort of a sadistic world with a great deal of reward connected with it. Now, I think your case has been primarily built on women. I understand that's what you're talking about, but if it existed in almost equal numbers in males, and I believe it does, if it certainly sexual masochism and sadism exist in males, then I think where would your argument be if it wasn't only female related, or you took societal factors into account?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think, first of all, with respect, see, saints and martyrs are the other the other group that fit that pattern. I think that if you ask the football players, if you didn't have to get your knees smashed up and your face punched in order to get that cheering and that approbation, would you do it? They'd do it. You know, I think that if you, I think there too, it's the approval and the applause and so on that they're really seeking. And I think in terms of the sexual masochists among males, what some of them say parallels what the Samoa people say. And so I won't repeat that, but for some of the male masochists in particular, they will tell you that to be put in a subordinate position and in a powerless position is a relief for them from having to live up to the tough male in control role. And for that reason, it's pleasurable. And then some of their sexual masochism is these other things. They're guilty about their sexuality. And so if you beat them, or if they're, you know, Freud talked about how the nurse that used to spank the child and he got aroused during the spanking and so on. If he could have gotten aroused without the spanking, I think he would have gotten aroused without the spanking. I mean, this is associative learning. It's a perfect behaviorist model. And so I think the fact that some people have learned to experience pleasure at the same time as pain teaches them not to seek out the pain per se, but to seek out the pain so that they can get the pleasure. Yes?
You said something about the word martyr, and it conjured up the whole image of the masochist, mm-hmm. and the mother the martyr, or women the martyr. Mm-hmm. I wondered where else that fit.
Okay, well, when you're a martyr, you are willing to endure suffering for a greater cause. Now, if you're a saint, you're not supposed to want the approbation, but you are helping the kingdom of heaven. And so, insofar, I mean, I have to be careful here because a lot of what goes on in organized religion is very good, and I don't want to demean that. But I think that saints probably feel happy and fulfilled to see that. I think Mother Teresa enjoys making the poor happier. You know, I don't think that saints and martyrs are people who simply suffer and enjoy the suffering. They feel proud or fulfilled knowing that they are working toward a greater good. And that's how, when your kids are driving you crazy, you know, you stop and think to yourselves, okay, all right, but I know that this, ultimately, they're going to be the better for this. You know, they hate me now because I'm making them go to bed, and I feel like a criminal for doing it and so on, and I wish I didn't. It'd be easier to let them stay up as late as they want. But I know it's for a greater good. I know I'm being a good person by setting the limits. Of course. I certainly hope so.
I know we could go on for a long time. Perhaps we